This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University scholar Ture Reed tells GLT's Judy Valente the nation owes a lot to Martin Luther King, both in the civil rights struggle and in economic diversity.
By the end of the 20th century, there is truly a black middle class in America, which King would certainly have been encouraged by.
It's the 50th anniversary of the King assassination. We also mark this date with Personal Remembrances of King, a dramatic production from the Illinois Voices Theater Echoes, and museum exhibits. Plus, Bloomington Normal by the numbers, economist Mike Dougherty visits the studio. It's Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The words and deeds of Martin Luther King Jr. touched many in central Illinois. To mark the 50th anniversary of the loss of the great civil rights leader, the McLean County Museum of History is hosting a multimedia tribute featuring Illinois Voices Theater Echoes, Dr. King, I Remember. It dramatizes letters and poems dedicated to Dr. King.
Dr. King, I remember it was like a dark cloud following your assassination. I was only six, but I remember. Everything was so tense. People watching the TV and walking around asking what happened. We felt that you, Dr. King, had allowed us to dream. When things are bad and I question whether there is progress being made, I hang on to your words and the idea that someday we will be where we are supposed to be. I hang on to that.
Have a dream. We will live free, and we can make it be, and we can make it be.
We walked. We would not ride the bus, Montgomery 55. Our feet were tired, our souls alive, striding side by side, striding side by side.
This alone is what I wish for you, knowledge, to know we are responsible for the lives we change. No faith comes without cost. No one believes without dying.
In Nashville, students just sat down to order lunch one day. No one waited on them, so they sat day after day. They sat day after day.
In Birmingham, we filled the streets with 1,000 children's feet. When they were carted off to jail, more children kept the beat. More children kept the beat.
In 63, we had a dream that we could all live free. We marched on Washington, D.C. for all the world to see. For all the world to see.
When I look back at your assassination and the 50 years that have passed, I want my students and other young people to remember that there was a person long ago, when things were probably at their worst, who believed in something and was willing to give his life for that belief.
In 64, we hoped for more, and thousands volunteered.
Taught freedom schools, turned out the vote, together persevered. Together persevered. We were not stopped by death, nor fright.
In Selma 65, clergy joined our freedom march to gain full voting rights. To gain full voting rights. By 65, we had legal rights, but life wasn't full and good. We took on Northern City Blight for housing, jobs, and schools. For housing, jobs, and schools. Women roared for equal rights. We opposed the Vietnam War.
Poor people pitched tents on the mall. We dreamed large dreams for all. We dreamed large dreams for all.
Believe in yourself. Go ahead. See where it gets you.
During these trying times, I am reminded that we have traveled these unsteady waters before. In your 1963 I Have a Dream speech, you state that you refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt, and I am holding on to that belief. I have seen proof of bettering humanity. At just 8 years old, I watched you give your life for those beliefs and have seen many positive shifts in these last 50 years. Your I Have a Dream speech laid out a hope and a vision for this country. You state, no, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream.
It is a great mistake to think of nonviolence as powerless. You pushed against the institutions and the powers and the authorities, knowing when you pushed, they would show their true colors, which they did with dogs, burning buses, and murder. You produced conflict to move to a new level of justice.
I want to thank you for the seed of love and compassion for humanity that you gave your life to plant. I want to let you know that your dream has been watered and that seed has grown. You let us know darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. When I see Black Lives Matter or any group taking to the streets across the country and organizing peaceful protest, I am reminded and inspired that your dream for equality and justice for all is still relevant 50 years since you have passed.
I think people need to know that if it were not for you, Dr. King, we would still be struggling.
Dreams aren't cast in bronze or stone, and 50 years are gone. The only way a dream can live is when hearts take it on. So will you join us in the dream for full equality? Turn off the TV, stand and sing. All people shall live free. All people shall live free.
That's Catherine Brown, Dara Griffin, Brandon Albee, and Susan Thietard from Illinois Voices Theater Echoes. Their performance of Dr. King, I Remember, is tomorrow night at 7 p.m. in the Governor Pfeiffer Courtroom of the McLean County Museum of History in Bloomington. This story was produced by Laura Kennedy. The civil rights leader was shot while standing on a motel balcony in Memphis. He had gone to that city to protest the working conditions and low wages of the mostly black city sanitation workers. Touré Reed is co-chair of African American Studies at Illinois State University. He tells GLT's Judy Valente King was shifting his focus to economic justice at the time of his death, and that high unemployment and poverty rates among American blacks today show how much of King's dream remains unrealized.
The March on Washington in 1963 was actually motivated by the ubiquitous disparities in income and unemployment. And its aims included a number of things that we don't generally think of as civil rights aims. They included a full employment economy, jobs programs, by which I mean public works programs specifically, which would mean that the government would create jobs directly for unemployed or underemployed workers, an increase to the federal minimum wage, etc. King obviously signed off, he endorsed that agenda, but as the organizers of the March on Washington of 1963 had stated at the time, anti-discrimination legislation alone would fail to close the gap between blacks and whites, because what was at play, and at this point had been at play for about a decade, was the transformation of the American economy. So, with automation, eliminating high-paying unionized jobs that didn't require a lot of formal education, simply passing anti-discrimination legislation would do little to redress the sources of economic inequality that impacted the black masses.
It could be argued that when Dr. King was killed, the civil rights movement was already faltering. Many of his followers were getting impatient, calling for more violent reactions. He had lost some supporters in the white community, not to mention President Johnson. What do you think his death created at that moment? Did it create a greater support than for civil rights, or did it stall things?
Narrowly, I think it's pretty clear that King's assassination helped to generate support for the civil rights Act, or I should say the Civil Rights Movement's last major legislative victory, the Civil Rights Act of 1968, Title VIII of which is known as the Fair Housing Act. King had a very clear association with fair housing insofar as that was one of the demands of the 1963 March on Washington. King had was involved in the open housing protests in Chicago in 1966. So the combination of King's martyrdom the near simultaneous release just a month before his assassination of the Kerner Commission report, which had likewise called for fair housing legislation, helped to facilitate passage of the 1968 Civil Rights Act, right? President Johnson was motivated in the immediate aftermath of King's murder to pressure Congress to act on fair housing legislation. And the Civil Rights Act of 1968, I think, was passed a week or maybe 2 weeks after King's assassination. So short term, King's murder had an effect on civil rights that really galvanized support for action, right? Legislative action.
The riots that occurred in many cities, most notably Washington, D.C., after the King assassination, what effect did that have on either speeding things up or in some ways slowing them down? Because people who may have supported some of the goals of Dr. King then saw these riots and turned against them.
Long term, the riots, obviously, along with the anti-war movement, the Vietnam anti-war movement, galvanized people on the other side and helped to usher in President Nixon's law and order presidency, which would obviously have some negative implications for black civil rights. To be fair, I don't know that it was evident in 1968 that Nixon's election augured the beginning of the end. But in essence, I think the riots, along with the anti-war movement, demonstrated a disillusionment with democratic capital D liberalism, at least post-war democratic liberalism, that weakened the Democratic Party, but also emboldened the opposition.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm with Dr. Tory Reed, who is co-director of African American Studies here at ISU. We're talking about Dr. King's legacy. Dr. King had always been advocating nonviolent resistance, and it just seemed that with his death, that whole idea of fighting for social change with nonviolent tactics just went by the wayside. What are your thoughts on that?
I think prior to his death, many young people in particular were disillusioned with nonviolent protest. Nonviolent protest is a tactic that worked in the context in which the U.S. could be shamed. The slow pace from the vantage point of African Americans of progress, of material progress, contributed substantially to a loss of confidence, a loss in confidence, or a loss of confidence in the capacity of nonviolent protest to deliver. What's more consequential than the disillusionment that people had with nonviolent protest is the rise of the Black Power movement. And the Black Power movement, there are many positive things that one can say about it insofar as racial pride for Black Americans was something that understandably many Black Americans took to in a nation that denigrated African Americans, right? But the negative aspects of the Black Power movement come down to legitimating tribalism, right? Legitimating a kind of separatist politics that King and others understood made coalition building really quite difficult. And in a context in which Black Americans were a minority in a democratic society, they needed coalitions, right? Black Americans needed to ally with other people that didn't quote unquote look like them, who shared many of the concerns that they did. And Black Power, I think, had a kind of chilling effect on the civil rights movement's capacity to deliver.
Do you see today's Black Lives Matter efforts to be more in line with Dr. King's nonviolent movement, or more in line with the Black Power movement?
I think in many ways it's more in line with the Black Power movement. And I think that's something that King would be disappointed in, if only because if one were to look at the issues that have motivated Black Lives Matter, and these are crucial issues, right? The problems of police brutality, the excesses of the criminal justice system, the problems of related problems of mass incarceration are all really quite consequential to the lives of Black people. But they're also consequential to the lives of many white people and Latinos as well. The Black Lives Matter movement is heterogeneous, I think, in terms of its membership. And there are a lot of people who are participants who understand that there's more to the movement than a focus on Black Americans. There are other people in the movement who maybe get more attention than is merited, who have embraced too narrow a focus. And consequently, I think that makes it more complicated or more difficult to bring about the kind of change that's needed to end police brutality, the excesses of the criminal justice system, or mass incarceration.
Where are we, would you say, today in terms of civil rights? Would Dr. King be pleased? After all, women, gays, transgender people have all won great strides, but there remains a long way to go. And we seem to be retreating into tribes, us against them mentality.
I suspect King would look on a landscape that he understood to be a mixed bag. In the aftermath of the civil rights movement, we have an explosion in the number of Black elected officials. One might argue ultimately culminating in the election of the nation's first president who happened to be Black. So I think you've got that. You have the genesis as well, and in the era following the Civil Rights Act of 1964, of a real Black middle class, right? I mean, prior to the 1960s, maybe even prior to World War II, what constituted the Black middle class was more cultural than economic. By the end of the 20th century, there is truly a Black middle class in America, which King would certainly have taken some credit for and been encouraged by. At the same time, the disparities persist. Blacks continue to be overrepresented among the nation's poor and unemployed. They're overrepresented among the inmate population, etc. And so I suspect that King would think that there is much work to be done, which he was aware of by, 1968, right? King had shifted focus from the traditional civil rights issues, the issues centered on enforcement of the 14th and 15th Amendments, in favor of economic justice. And I think, if nothing else, the lingering disparities highlight the prescience of people like A. Philip Randolph, Bayard Rustin in the early 1960s, and King by the late 1960s, in understanding that simply eliminating the racial barriers, the formal racial barriers to equality, would be inadequate. We needed a more economically fair society.
Torrey Reed is with the History Department of Illinois State University. He's the co-director of the African American Studies Program. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about Dr. King's legacy.
Thank you for having me, Judy.
I'm Judy Valente.
A recent study by the Public Religion Institute found 3/4 of American whites say they have no close friends who are Black. The vast majority of African Americans say they have no close friends who are white. The study concluded Americans support racial integration in the abstract, but have a harder time practicing it in their private lives. The fight for civil rights continues in Bloomington Normal as activists push local leaders on the Welcoming City Ordinance and for better police-citizen relations. In Bloomington, Mayor Terry Renner says he hopes to use the 50th anniversary of King's death to have a community dialogue about the opportunities and challenges we face, unquote. Renner tells GLT's Ryan Denham he is hosting an open house Friday that will continue the conversations that King began.
From 4:30 to 5:30 on Friday is my typical open house. But for about the first half hour, I want to show the film from the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis. It is in the motel where King was assassinated, the Lorraine Motel. And it talks about the day that he was assassinated, the events leading up to it. And I wanted to mention a few things and talk a little bit about his letter from the Birmingham jail. And the purpose of this is obviously to remind people of this event, a very critical event in American history 50 years ago, but also that this was the process of us becoming a more perfect union. And that is people who could not vote. Martin Luther King did not live to see that election, which was the first time in American history, November 1968, where a majority of non-whites voted in the United States, 103 years after the Civil War. So the process of becoming a perfect union in the United States has not been a rapid one. It is very important for us to keep that in mind as we move forward. Martin Luther King tried to appeal to the best of us as human beings, and we will have no shortage of people trying to gain political advantage by appealing to the worst of us as human beings. So I think more than ever, this is a critical event.
King obviously has a special place in history for Illinois Wesleyan University, where you work, having spoken there.
Twice.
Yeah, twice. Right. So what's your sense of how much King means to this community in particular?
Well, I think King obviously means a lot to many people in the community, some of them depending upon perhaps their status or how they, obviously, human beings are going to view the world depending upon where they sit, right? I'm a white, middle-aged male, right? If I had been born in a different set of circumstances, I might have viewed the world differently. I was in a single-parent household where my mom and I were on and off welfare from the time I was 8 to the time I was 15. I lived in a homeless shelter for a month when I was 10. I see the world differently than others. To me, and as someone who spent my whole life studying America and American politics and political change in society, the civil rights movement, as symbolized by King, means an enormous amount, something that we can really be proud of in the United States.
Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for coming in and for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Ryan. Take care.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham speaking with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. That MLK-themed open house is Friday at 4:30 at Bloomington City Hall. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Many other institutions are marking the King anniversary today, among them the Central Illinois African American History Museum, just outside Oakwood Cemetery in Springfield. That's where Lincoln lies buried. IPR's Rachel Otwell talks with Museum Coordinator Doris Bailey.
The panel here I like most is the one that talks about his life with his family, his father, his mother, his children. A lot of people don't know, but Martin Luther King's name was not always Martin Luther King. His original name was Michael King. So we could be today celebrating Michael King Day. However, his father was a minister, and he actually was studying about Martin Luther, the priest. And so at 2 years old, his father changed their name. He was already, if the senior changes his name, he needs to change the junior's name. So he changed both their names to Martin Luther King. And so that's where we get that from. And then on the picture on this panel here, it also has pictures of him and his family, his four little children that he spoke about in his I Have a Dream speech. He talks about he wants his children, his four little children, to be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. So we have pictures of him and his family there.
And so this goes through pretty much a timeline of his life. One panel here talks about something that I don't know if I never heard about it or just had forgotten, but a stabbing that he had endured at one point and how that kind of tied into his views on pacifism.
His philosophy about nonviolence, of course he's a Christian, those values come from that, but yet he also studied Gandhi. So he kind of combined or intertwined those philosophies together to get that nonviolence resistance movement that he was a part of.
And he traveled to India after he was stabbed with a letter opener at a book signing in Harlem. Can we move on and look at maybe some of the items here in a glass case?
Yes, definitely. These items here in the case were loaned to us by Carolyn and Curtis Farrara. Miss Farrara, she was actually a member of Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King ministered at in Atlanta, Georgia. And so we have in the case, we have a book that Martin Luther King wrote and signed for Miss Farrara, Why We Can't Wait. And then we have another book here that's called Strength to Love that he also wrote, but his wife, Coretta Scott King, signed that book. Then we have the original obituary from his funeral. And I like to point out, we copied the obituary and we have it laid out here. He kind of had a premonition like the day before his passing that something may have happened, where he talked about, I've been to the mountaintop. But he, a few months before that, he actually may have had, I think he must have had another premonition, because he talked about a sermon he gave at his church, talked about his own funeral, where he didn't want people to remember him for the Nobel Peace Prize that he had won or the other 300-400 other awards. He wanted people to remember him, remember that he tried to love and serve humanity. And I think that's so important. It's a little eerie because they played that very sermon at his funeral. So he was like, he's giving his own eulogy at his own funeral, you know, and that's a little eerie, but yet it's very powerful nonetheless.
That was Doris Bailey, museum coordinator at the Springfield and Central Illinois African American History Museum. She spoke with Rachel Otwell about the Martin Luther King Jr. exhibit there, which will be on display through the end of the year. While many will remember King for his leadership, IPR's Brian O'Keefe has the story of King's personal impact on one man's life.
Dr. Ernie Gibson was the first African-American hired at College of DuPage. Long before he arrived at the campus of the Glen Ellen-based community college, Gibson was active in the civil rights movement. He was a member of the Tuskegee Civic Association while a student, and later a member of the faculty at Tuskegee University. During his work with the TCA, Gibson met the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He says King became a mentor and eventually a friend, and it was a friendship that shaped his life.
In college, I played basketball and football. I think I was rather aggressive. I could never turn the other cheek. I was very combative. I discovered a grace and a love. I guess I discovered my fellow man. From Dr. King, I learned to turn the other cheek.
While the nation and world remembers the 50th anniversary of the Reverend King's assassination this week, Gibson says he remembers Dr. King every Friday.
Dr. King was assassinated helping garbage men. Whenever I see anybody working, picking up garbage, it resonates with me. I live in Olympia Fields, and they pick up my garbage every Friday. They have black men, white men, young men. In the summertime, I always have pop, and my wife always makes sandwiches. That's all from Dr. King's teaching. Now, the neighbors don't like it. They go, why do you do that? And I tell them, you know, don't treat them like garbage men.
Dr. Ernie Gibson worked with the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. during the height of the civil rights movement and talked with King just days before the assassination. I'm Brian O'Keefe.
This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a look at the culture of charter schools, and one in particular that is resulting in high teacher turnover. That's an IPR report coming up. There are some seriously low unemployment numbers for Bloomington Normal coming out. Seems like the McLean County economy ought to be soaring, but it's more complicated than that, according to economist Mike Doherty. Doherty is giving the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council's quarterly update on the economic progress of McLean County tomorrow at a Bone Student Center luncheon.
Housing was flat in terms of prices January and February compared to January and February of last year. We're waiting to see, are we going to continue to get this healthy rate of appreciation on existing homes that we saw last year? It was very exciting to see a 4.5% average gain year over year, 2017 compared to 2016. But it's too early to tell, winter months being what they are for the housing market, to see whether that's going to continue on into 2018.
How would you assess the impact of State Farm's job announcements? 900 IT jobs leaving the community, several hundred claims jobs coming in, some retirements, some forced separations. Some people, of course, will retire and stay in the community. Some will not. Whatever wage differential there is between IT jobs and claims jobs could be reflected in the housing market. What are you anticipating will be the impact on the realty sector?
I would think it would soften it just a little bit, but you know, the net change in jobs is in the hundreds, so a pretty small percentage of our total labor force. We've got 90,000 people working here in Bloomington Normal, so the marginal impact is pretty small. And if you look back over financial services sector, which is our largest sector because of State Farm, 20,000, roughly 21,000, it's held very steady over the last 5 years. It's down a little bit from its absolute peak, but you know, we really haven't had much change. 2017 numbers were in line with 2016 numbers. In fact, it's up by a couple hundred. So I think in the end, comparing over the last next three, if you look, average it over the last 3 or 4 years, I don't think you'll see much change from that.
How about within the housing market? Will there be certain segments of priced homes that will have a larger inventory or a lower inventory?
Well, in some ways, I guess I'm a little skeptical that we'll maintain this. You know, this, we had this very high rate of appreciation compared to past years. We've been flat in terms of existing home appreciation here for years. And then we had this 4.5% gain last year. And I'm skeptical because of seeing the decline in the labor force numbers. We just, you know, we've got fewer people in the labor force, and our employment numbers are not bouncing back to higher levels. So it's kind of hard to imagine where would future gains in those housing prices come from without an increase in State Farm or some other major employer.
Why is the labor force continuing to decline?
Well, there's been some interesting studies out on that. One study blamed at least half of it on the opiate crisis and saying that...
Come again?
Well, there was a study out on that about a year and a half ago saying that about half the middle-aged men not looking for work and not working, therefore not in the labor force, were on pain medication and said it was enough that caused pain in their daily life. So that's one possibility of it. But more likely, retirement is the leading reason for the decline in the labor force, just simply the aging of the American population.
How are we doing on the unemployment front?
Well, we're doing great. We're down to below 4%. Keep in mind, even though we are the lowest unemployment rate in the state of Illinois, which is something to be good, feel good about, we're higher than surrounding states. It's sort of surprising. You look at the other Midwestern states, they're all lower than Illinois is.
Why is that?
I don't know why. Missouri only 3.2, Wisconsin 2.9, Iowa, theirs historically was driven by the fact that they were such an agricultural state and agriculture was doing very well. But now agriculture is not doing well. It has not been doing well for 4 years, and yet they still have a less than a 3% unemployment rate.
So, how do you expect the numbers for Bloomington Normal and McLean County to shift with the Trump tariffs and with the Chinese retaliation in the ag sector?
Well, I would say fortunately, you know, we're such a service-based economy. you know, we're going to be somewhat insulated from that, although we will be affected. I mean, we have a big agricultural base in Decatur, ag-related industries. We have ag-related and these are export industries in Caterpillar and Peoria and John Deere in Quad Cities. So we are, you know, there. It could have some small impact, but I would not expect retaliatory tariffs to have much of an impact in the Bloomington normal economy.
Not a big pork producing center.
No, we do have pork production in the state of Illinois, but we don't have any nearby. As far as you know, where that would have the biggest immediate impact would be where you have your big slaughter packing facilities, like in Monmouth, and that they could be affected.
We do have a couple hog farms.
We have some hog farmers here in the county, and to the extent that it has already, just the threat of the tariff, as soon as that was announced, it decreased the hog prices. So there would be a small impact there. But percentage-wise, in terms of total sales, Bloomington Normal, if you just say call it McLean County, it's predominantly driven by corn and soybean prices. And so we haven't seen an impact over retaliatory tariffs on the grain and oil seeds yet.
Let's get back to the employment numbers. How has the size of the workforce shifted in the last 3 years?
Well, I crunched some numbers there from Bureau of Labor Statistics reports, and in 2015, we were above 94,000 employed here. In fact, 95,000 April, May, and then we came into 2016 at around 93,000. So there was a drop there. In the spring, it was down year over year in 2016 by about 2,000 and down by about 800 if you looked at in the fall numbers. So how did 2017 match up? Again, in the spring, which is our high point for employment here, we have two high points in Bloomington Normal, which is the spring and the fall. And in March through May, we were back up there around 93,000. So we were matching 2016. So no real decline, at least at that point, last year compared to the year before. But then in the fall, we were down a little bit by an average on looking across the months at about 500 to 600 fewer employed.
What do you gather from that?
Well, somebody cut back somewhere. Basically, there's been some slippage there. Now, we as you saw, the IDES numbers year over year for February over February and January over January were up, right, by 700, 800 jobs, not number of people employed. So maybe we picked up some part-time work that continued past the Christmas shopping season. I don't know. But in terms of actual number of people employed, something softened somewhere.
Is it resulting from employers saying, I want more full-timers and fewer temps, which might actually be an encouraging sign for the economy?
These are two different surveys. So there's a job survey that's updated every month. And there's a Bureau of Labor Statistics survey for employed people. So you're looking at two different databases. So you have to be kind of careful drawing comparisons between the two. It's better to look at just one database over time. If we had a drop of 500 people employed, you're saying maybe you're right. It could be a positive thing if those people all had been working two part-time jobs and now had one full-time job. But looking across the industry sectors, I was looking for that answer in those industry breakouts.
So what are the different sectors telling us?
So education and health services, pretty much even the last few years. So that takes in ISU, and you know we have a big education base here, and health services, our hospital base, that's a big base, 11,000. It's even higher than in 2012, 2014. So we have had some growth. And we've held on to that growth in that sector. Leisure and hospitality ended in a high note in 2017. We had over 6 months last year of over 12,000 people employed in that sector in Bloomington Normal. And that's an all-time high going back 10 years. Professional and business services, they were down slightly for the second year in a row compared to previous highs. Of course, that's tied to the State Farm, which you would expect. Financial activities, very much in line, surprising, with, you know, because that takes in State Farm, very much in line with our peak back in 2010 and 2011 in that 20,000 to 200, 20,600 range. Very little change there. Manufacturing down, like, as we know.
Let's go back to professional and business services for a moment. The nationwide trend is that core employment in a given sector goes down, and that, and as those jobs get shifted to consulting jobs, the professional and business services tally goes up.
Right.
So that's not happening here?
Apparently not. If you look at the BLS numbers, we were down slightly between 9,500 and 10,000 compared to our old peak in 2011. In 2011, we had 11,000 people in that category, and now we're down around 9,500 to 10,000. So about a 5% to 10% drop there.
So that bucking the trend is an artifact of State Farm and its unique circumstances in its digital reinvention.
It would look like that. It would look like that, yeah.
Okay.
And we also had an interesting on that same note, might play into the same weakness in that sector, was in information services, which you would have expected those to be increasing over time. They have not. Here in Bloomington Normal, they were down slightly in 2017. They're down in general, about 500 to 600 people in that sector, down from the level of 800 we had back in 2010 through 2015.
Is there anything to be gleaned from the number out of people, number of people out of work and looking for a job that stays within the range of 3,400 to 3,900 people unemployed?
You know, I would just think that when I see these kinds of unemployment numbers, 3.5% to 3.8%, it's got to be a struggle for employers out there. They must In order to find workers, they must be pulling people in from a part-time basis to full-time or something, increasing their hours per week. Because at that point, and keeping in mind with the falling labor force numbers, so you got a smaller pool you're drawing out of. That's part of why you're getting down to those low percentage numbers. You have less people sitting on the sidelines, and you pretty much come across, you know, a rocky bottom eventually there, where there's the only way you're going to hire somebody is to hire them away from someone else. So you got to compete with that person's wage, or you got to bring them in, and there's costs involved with that, but getting them from another community.
Are we at the mythical full employment level?
According to the long term, most economists would say yes, that this is, you can't get much below this, even though we are seeing those lower numbers, though, in neighboring states. So maybe we could still get down to maybe 3%, 3.2%. That's phenomenally low when you look at that there's always people out there who are between jobs.
You would expect that to have an inflationary effect or a rising effect on wages then?
Yes. So
is that happening?
Well, we had a slight gain nationally, 2.5% gain year over year in January. So that was probably the first substantial gain we've had like that for a while. So there is a little bit of upward wage pressure. How much that's happening here in Bloomington Normal, I don't know.
Mike Dougherty is an economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau, and he's giving us Bloomington Normal by the numbers. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
Bloomington Normal by the Numbers is tomorrow from 11:30 to 1 in the Bone Student Center Prairie Room. The keynote speaker will be Illinois Tourism Director Corey Jobe, talking about the economic power of tourism.
Kinds of ways to listen to GLT.
And during this fun drive, you can win one of the newest ways to listen with an Amazon Echo. Hello, I'm Alexa.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. Smart speakers can help with all kinds of things.
Like playing your favorite public radio station.
During this fun drive, you could win one of 10 Echo speakers with my new friend, Alexa.
Mike, we're not friends.
But we are, sort of, right?
Whatever.
Contribute and learn how you can win a smart speaker at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from SEFCU, partnering with car dealers throughout Central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The trend toward school choice has educators across the country looking at Chicago's Noble Charter Schools as a model. The award-winning network of mostly high schools specializes in helping inner-city kids achieve the kind of SAT scores that propel them into four-year universities. But despite its prestigious reputation, Noble has a peculiarly high teacher turnover rate. As Dusty Rhodes reports for Illinois Newsroom, some of those teachers are speaking up about charter policies they describe as dehumanizing.
Noble's handbook contains a detailed dress code. Light khakis, school polo shirts that must be tucked in, black belts, black dress shoes, plus rules about hair.
Every morning I would color in two of my boys' parts.
This is Carice Epps. When she taught at Noble's Hansberry College Prep, the network had a rule. Boys could have only one straight line in their hair. A couple of Epps' students had lines that curved, but she knew how to help them avoid punishment.
I had a hefty amount of eyeliner at my desk, so I just colored in with brown or black eyeliner.
Ann Baltzer taught chemistry at Hansberry. When one of her female students showed up with braids that included strands of maroon, the school color, the girl was told she couldn't attend class, so she asked Baltzer to use a black marker to obliterate the maroon in each braid. The teacher looks back on that as not only unnecessary, but racist.
To have a system that results in a white woman having to color on a black woman's hair, and if I don't, she's excluded from education, there's something wrong with that.
Some teachers embrace Noble's culture.
If one of my students came to school with red hair, I would say you knew. You totally knew that you shouldn't have red hair.
That's Annie Bell. She was fresh out of college when she became a chemistry teacher at Noble's Johnson College Prep. She believes Noble's rules are necessary to mold low-income Black and Latino students into college material.
I really trusted the system and I really trusted my principal. And so I just enforced it all. I will say it's easy to question one piece, but when I look at the system as a whole, I really think it needs all of the pieces to accomplish what we accomplished.
Bell and Baltzer both left Noble after 4 years, and that's not unusual. Five Noble campuses lost at least half their teachers over the past 4 years. Part of that is due to burnout. The charter network requires teachers to work long hours, but some, like Baltzer, had deeper reasons.
It's a completely dehumanizing system both for teachers and students.
For example, staff could spontaneously demand silence or level zero in the lunchroom and hallways.
We had no awareness that it would be inappropriate to shout hands up at a hallway full of black children. And so we had white teachers shouting hands up and kids putting their hands up and going silent. That is insane.
One Hansberry alum told us he remembers level zero being imposed for weeks on end. But Ellen Metz, principal of Noble's oldest charter school, says the network's guiding concept is that rules are grounded in purpose rather than power.
Some of the stuff that you're talking about, like from the level zero for days and weeks, like, you know, we serve 12,000 families in Chicago. This would be headlines if this was happening on a regular basis. Families would be up in arms, like all 12,000 of them. They're just not.
Jane Sundius, a social psychologist who focuses on poverty and education, says low-income families tend not to question systems like Noble. She points to a study by sociologist Melvin Cohn exploring how parenting styles vary by social class.
What he found was that working-class parents focused very much on obedience. Off little Johnny went to school and his mom said, "Listen to the teacher, be quiet." The working class parents trained their children to be workers on an assembly line, not empowered.
Discipline varies widely among Noble 17 schools, but data we obtained shows students at five predominantly black Noble campuses get about twice the number of demerits as students at Noble's 10 predominantly Hispanic schools. Carice Epps couldn't do it. She came to Noble after teaching in Detroit schools and never made peace with Noble's discipline system. Like roughly one in five teachers at Hansberry, she left after just 1 year.
I sat and reflected on the fact that I trained my students to close the door if a student was being perp walked, because for discipline issues, like a fight, our children were arrested and walked out of the school. And I was useless. I could not help that child.
Noble gets support from across the political spectrum. Both Governor Bruce Rauner and the family of his Democratic rival, J.B. Pritzker, have donated enough money to Noble that they have schools named after them. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Illinois Newsroom is a collaboration focused on expanding coverage of education, state politics, health, and the environment.
NPR One is a whole new way to listen.
I like that it mixes things for me automatically.
Catch up on NPR and GLT News. Customize the app for you.
It looks at the content that I'm looking at, I think. It feels like the thing is starting to anticipate things that I might like.
Share what you like. Skip what you don't. It's public radio made personal.
Hi, I'm Greg Kosorik from Bloomington, Illinois, and I listen to NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at WGLT.org/NPR1.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews with help today from Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, and Ryan Denham. Also, thanks to everyone in the GLT newsroom. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or call. Leave a message about the show at 438-WGLT. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.